Hello.
Hi, and welcome to Mass Murder, a true crime self-care podcast. We're your hostesses, Avery
and Nicole. And normally we tell you about two things, masks and murder. And last year, kind of around this time, I think, we did a 12 holiday murders, no mask. This year, we thought we'd kind of keep up with the same holiday theme. But this year, we're going to go with 8 crazy nights. Thanks, Adam Sandler. And we're going to split it up and we'll each tell you 4 stories that take place, maybe, sometime between like Thanksgiving and New Year's-ish.
Ish. And as you know, we aren't experts, so please don't take our comments as hard facts. We are just regular people with true crime obsession, so we're pretty much relying on the internet to give us the facts. But with that being said, let's just dig into it. All right, so I'm going to go first.
Yeah.
And, I guess if you guys listened to the last one, but we haven't actually read each other's. Some of these, yeah, we're all going to know a little bit, but a high-level look, especially at my first one, because it is a lengthy one that could definitely be at least one episode in and of itself. So I'm going to hit some highlights. All right. So my first story is the murder of Lacey Peterson.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. All right. Lacey Denise Peterson, in case you actually haven't heard of this one, was the subject of a highly publicized murder case when she disappeared while 8 months pregnant with her first child. On December 23rd, 2002, at 5:45 p.m., Lacey and her husband Scott went to Salon, where Lacey's sister Amy cut Scott's hair. They all chatted like normal, and Scott offered to pick up a fruit basket for their grandfather the next day because he would be playing at a golf course nearby. Lacey's mother Sharon then spoke with Lacey on the phone that evening around 8:30 p.m. The next day, Scott left their home at about 9:30 a.m., and he went to go fishing at the Berkeley Marina. He later told authorities that Lacey was watching a TV show, preparing for the holiday, and was going to walk their dog to a nearby park. Around 10:30 a.m., a neighbor of the Petersons stated that they found their dog alone outside the home and just put him back in the backyard. That afternoon, Scott returned home to find the house empty. Since he was gross from fishing, he went upstairs, showered, and washed his clothes.
Convenient. Also, I find it a little suspect that he said he was going golfing and then went fishing instead.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the neighbor, I also find it suspicious. Weird that they just put the dog in the yard and, like, knock on the door. Hey, like, your dog's running around.
Yeah, that's one thing I'm not sure if, like, the gate was maybe open. So you just kind of, like, assumed
that he got out.
Just, yeah. Like, pushed his way out or something. Because, like, that's happened to her. But I guess I also was, like, walking around. My dog. I'm pointing at my dog. But I was also, like, walking around the house, so then my neighbor was like, by the way,
yeah.
I put her in the backyard, and I was like, oh, yeah, thanks. Like, that could have been bad.
Yeah.
Anyway,
sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're not wrong. It's weird. But so when Lacey hadn't returned home that evening, Scott called his mother-in-law, and shortly, her stepfather called the police. Police arrived at the Peterson home and found Lacey's purse in a closet that contained her keys, wallet, and sunglasses. Although Scott initially said that he had spent the day playing golf, he later told police that he had indeed gone fishing at the Berkeley Marina, which is about 90 miles from the couple's Modesto home. He had left a message for Lacey that said, "Hey, beautiful, it's 2:15. I'm leaving Berkeley." Very specific.
Yeah.
Detectives immediately launched the search, but were surprised by Scott Peterson's behavior. Detectives were immediately thrown off by his calm, cool demeanor and lack of questioning. He didn't seem like too concerned of like, what are you doing? Where are we at?
Where's my pregnant wife?
Yep. Cool, calm, and collected. We'll go with that. So a large search for Lacey was set up. That sounded funny. It was set up including 30 officers as well as Lacey's loved ones and volunteers who posted flyers to raise awareness of her disappearance. On April 13th, 2003, a couple found a body of a late-term male fetus in a marshy area of the San Francisco Bay.
Mm.
One,
it would have been traumatizing.
I know. God, I can't imagine finding a dead body, let alone a baby.
Yeah.
But one day later, another passerby found the body of a recently pregnant woman who washed up on the rocky shoreline of the bay 1 mile from where the child's body was found. The corpse was decomposed to the point of being almost unrecognizable as a human body. The woman had been decapitated and her limbs were missing. On April 18th, 2003, The results of the DNA test verified that they were indeed the bodies of Lacey and her unborn son. Detectives, of course, were suspicious of the husband and later found out that Scott was having multiple affairs. The most recent affair was with Amber Fry. She agreed to help the police out and allowed them to record their phone calls. She told police on December 9th, 2 weeks before Lacey's disappearance, that Scott told her that he was a widower and that it would be his first Christmas without his wife. Weird, right?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah, a little foreshadowing. Scott was arrested on April 18th. He was charged with 2 felony counts of murder with premeditation and special circumstances. He pled not guilty. His trial began on June 1st of 2004, and on November 12th, Scott Peterson was convicted of first-degree murder for his wife's death and second-degree murder for the death of his unborn child, and received the death sentence. But on December 8th, 2001, yep, that's recent. Yep.
Okay. Sorry. I was like, why are you looking at me? I don't know the details.
I was going to say how far ago that was, but I couldn't think of today's date. Super recently.
20 years ago.
It was 20.
Super recently, the court resentenced Scott to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the first-degree murder of Lacey and a concurrent sentence of 15 years to life for the second-degree murder of his son. And that's the really short version of Lacey Peterson's story. But I've been watching the Hulu docuseries about this story, and there are so many more details.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, so many more. But, I mean, this is a story that I always knew about, but didn't know everything. Okay. So, I recommend it.
Cool.
It's interesting.
So, I'm going to take it back a little farther to 1926. And I'm going to talk about the disappearance of famed detective novelist Agatha Christie.
Which I'm real pumped about because I don't know the story.
I had no idea. I actually found out about this from that true crime calendar you gave me last year.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm going to read more about this.
Yeah.
And I used that in Wikipedia as my 2 sources for this. So take that for what you will.
Oh, yeah. I used a lot of Wikipedia for all of mine. Just going to call that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Heavy on the Wikipedia in this household.
Very heavy.
All right. So in case anybody doesn't know, Agatha Christie is an English author who's best known for her 66 detective novels and 14 short story collections. She was born Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller on September 15th of 1890 to a wealthy upper middle class family in Torquay, Devon. I should have looked up how to say that, but I don't care.
Yeah, that's fine.
She was the youngest of 3 children and was mostly homeschooled growing up. She wrote her first short story at just 18 years old. So we're going to fast forward it a little bit to October of 1912. Agatha was introduced to Archibald Christie, a.k.a. Archie, at a dance hosted by Lord and Lady Clifford.
I love that for you. That was great.
I know. So Archie was the son of a barrister and was in the Indian Civil Service. He was a Royal Artillery officer, and the two quickly fell in love. Just 3 months later, Archie proposed, and the two were married on Christmas Eve in 1914. And then World War I broke out. Archie was sent to France to fight, and not sure if Agatha was just being supportive of her husband or, you know, just the war efforts in general, but she stepped up and got involved as well. She was a member of the Voluntary Aid Detachment of the Red Cross. First, she worked as a nurse and then as a dispenser, followed by an apothecary's assistant. But then Archie got reassigned to London, and Agatha's own war efforts ended, which kind of makes me think she was just like, you're gone, I've got nothing to do, let me do something to support you. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah.
But she did settle into married life really quickly, and she gave birth to her and Archie's daughter, Rosalind Margaret Clarissa, in August of 1919. And I'm not going to lie, I've seen conflicting dates on this. One cites August 1926 as when there's trouble in paradise. And Wikipedia says that Archie did ask Agatha for a divorce because apparently he had fallen in love with another woman.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Her name was Nancy. Nancy Neal.
Nancy.
But the true crime calendar, you know, the gift that keeps on giving, says that Agatha discovered that Archie was having an affair with a younger woman on December 4th of 1926. So there's the two conflicting stories of what happened. And then on or around December, like, 3rd or 4th of 1926, Agatha vanished from her home, and sources agree that the next morning her car was found abandoned with the front wheels hanging over the edge of a chalk pit.
A chalk pit?
Like a quarry?
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's what I was picturing. Okay.
Yeah. Her expired license and clothes were found inside the car, and her disappearance was sensational. The press grabbed onto the story and tried to satisfy their readers' hunger for sensation, disaster, and scandal.
I mean, how can you not get so wrapped into a mystery writer's disappearance?
Right?
Come on.
Yeah. So more than 1,000 police officers, 15,000 volunteers, and several airplanes searched the rural landscape. Theories and rumors started making their way around. There was one that said that she may have committed suicide because she was supposedly, this is like unrelated to her husband being a cheater.
Mm-hmm.
She was supposed to have been driven mad by a murder-suicide that took place near her house.
I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah, I don't feel good about it. Seems dumb.
Yeah.
And then there was another rumor floating around that said she was just walking around the streets of London disguised as a man.
I mean, that was pretty ridiculous way back then.
Way back then, yeah. Nowadays, but people wouldn't even bat an eye.
Yeah, these are such weird excuses.
But, fun fact, Agatha's older brother had received a letter from her saying that she would be at a Yorkshire spa, but police were unconvinced by this. The search for her or her body continued. It even went as far as for psychics and mediums to get brought in to help find her, and they held seances to try to...
Oh, but of course!
But 9 days later, Agatha was found safe and sound. Do you want to know where she was found?
Yes, please.
At a Yorkshire spa.
No!
Suck it, police. You were wrong.
She was like, yeah, I just needed a little time for myself.
Yeah. She checked in under a fake name. Do you want to know what name she used?
Yeah.
The name of her husband's mistress.
That's baller. Oh, I love that.
Yeah. After she was found, kind of to get away from all of the press and everything, she just spent some time at her sister's house to, you know.
That's hilarious.
And that is the story of Miss Agatha Christie's disappearance. Wow,
the most positive story we've ever told.
I know.
Well, so I told you guys I was going to the spa.
And I went to the spa.
Wait, but what about her car?
I didn't find any explanation
for that. That's
so weird.
Yeah. Huh. God, I feel like if you're that talented, especially thinking about writing that many murder mysteries, maybe you do kind of live it a little bit, and she put a little mystery in her own life, but...
I'm hoping that she was trying to get, like, her cheater husband, like, framed for, like, her disappearance.
And maybe she, like, changed her mind. She's like, I'll come back. It's fine.
Yeah.
I have a pretty good life, so. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's my first story.
Oh, that's fun. Okay. All right. So my next one is really, it's rather different. I tried to do a wide range of stories.
Same.
So this one is called Christmas Injustice. And you'll see why.
Injustice? Like...
Not inside. Okay. But injustice.
Gotcha. Okay.
Cool. Unword.
Unword.
Okay. All right. And this one's kind of short.
Okay.
But, all right. In the early 1950s, Harry and Harriet Moore, for them.
It's so cute.
A married couple from Florida were activists in the civil rights movement. Being some of the loudest voices of their time, they quickly became targets for their not-so-widely accepted opinions and actions. On December 25th, 1951, they were celebrating Christmas at their home in Mims, Florida. It seemed like a nice, normal holiday, so why would the Moors expect anything unusual? Well, of course, that's when the worst things tend to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was also not only just Christmas for them, it was their 25th wedding anniversary.
Aww.
They were really thrilled to celebrate it with their young daughter at home, just, you know, the family.
Mm-hmm.
But tragedy struck that night. A bomb was placed under the floorboards of their home, detonated, killing both Harry and Harriet, but sparing their daughter, who was in another part of the house when the bomb exploded.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I know, it's really sad.
It's terrible.
Well, and also, the worst part is, when I was actually reading this, I was like, oh, I've heard this story. But there's just a billion of these stories.
Yeah. Ugh.
It's not the same story. But I'm sure at this point everyone's wondering, who would be so cruel to commit a terrorist act like this on Christmas? Well,
who was it?
Of course, the KKK.
Mm,
they had grown tired of Harry and Harriet's opinions and hoped to silence them. This fact wasn't even a question at the time, actually. Police figured it out rather quickly, but unfortunately were unable to arrest the perpetrators, which, when, you know, just continuing with my train of thought, when I read that, I was like, well, of course, the police just swept that under the rug. No, they were actually trying to get people. So, while the police were investigating the crime, two of the suspects actually died of natural causes within, like, that year.
Oh, good.
While the third committed suicide after being interviewed by the FBI twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they were actually looking for people, which I kind of didn't expect to be the end of the story. But there was something kind of like slightly positive that came out of this really horrible story. Even though the Klan tried to silence the movement against them and killed the Moors, it only empowered the civil rights movement even more. This short-sighted action from the Klan lit the fire under the cause, sparking numerous protests and nationwide anger towards the murders.
Wow.
So, yeah. Like, at least kind of like part of the larger puzzle, hopefully.
Yeah.
But really, really sad.
Really sad.
Mm. I know. But at least her daughter was okay. I kind of wanted to look and see if she gave, like, any interviews or anything, but...
Do you know how old she was?
No, the article I was reading didn't say.
It just said young, yeah.
Yeah, so under 18.
Yeah.
But that's all I got.
Got it. I'm going to assume under 10 if they said young.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. Also, in the 50s, like, well, no, I guess... It doesn't matter.
Yeah, either way.
I'm not sure.
So you said you tried to do a wide variety of stories. So did I.
All right.
My next one is a little crazy. Mm. It is the resurrection of Anne Green. And it took place back in the 1600s. 1650 to be specific.
Ooh, you're going real back in time.
Real far back. So, Anne was born in Steeple Barton, Oxfordshire, United Kingdom, around... 1628. As a young adult, she worked as a scullery maid, which was the lowest ranked and usually the youngest maids, and they were typically the kitchen maid's assistants. She worked in the house of Sir Thomas Reed. Now, again, there's a little bit of conflicting, you know, whatever. Oh, I also found this one on the calendar you gave me.
Fun fact. Trends.
Yeah, the gift that keeps on giving, man. I'm telling you, for real. So, on the true crime calendar page, it says that she was raped by her employer's 16 or 17-year-old grandson. But according to the Wikipedia page and executedtoday.com, they both say that she was seduced by him. Either way.
Yeah, probably semantics to be real.
Yeah. Either way, she ended up pregnant. She gave birth to a stillborn baby in an outhouse and later would claim that she wasn't even aware of her pregnancy until she gave birth.
What horrible circumstances.
Right?
Oh, just let me casually pop off to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And then, oh God, the trauma. Woo!
Unrelated to this, I've watched that show, I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant, and there are so... I don't remember what it's on, but I've watched it, and there's literally just like, people are like, oh, yeah, I thought I really had to, you know, take a shit. And I went to the bathroom, and a baby came out.
Yeah, I don't. Like, what? No comprende.
Woo. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, after she gave birth to the stillborn baby, she tried to conceal his body, but it was ultimately discovered. Her employer, Sir Thomas, prosecuted Anne under the Concealment of Birth of Bastards Act of 1624.
What a name!
Yes.
Oh, wow. All right.
So this act legally presumed that a woman concealing the death of an illegitimate child had murdered it.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's super cool, guys.
Right? So medical examiners at the time confirmed that the baby was underdeveloped and there was no way that he could have been alive when he was born.
That's so sad.
Regardless of this fact, Anne was found guilty of infanticide.
Shut the fuck up.
Nope. And she was sentenced to die by hanging on December 14th, 1650 at Oxford Castle.
We were a fucked up race back then.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
So Anne went to her friends and, you know, made a request of them to make sure that she was truly dead from the hanging. Because, you know, they're not always successful. And so at her request, they pulled and struck her swinging body to make sure she was dead. It's also reported that a nearby soldier struck her 4 or 5 times the butt of his musket to, like, essentially put her out of her misery. And then, I know, I wish I could, like, show the listeners your face right now.
Oh, my God.
So then her body was cut down and was given to the University of Oxford's medical school for to be dissected.
Uh-huh.
The next day, physicians William Petty and Thomas Willis were scheduled to dissect her body, but they opened her coffin. Weird that it was still it was the 1600s.
Yeah, sure.
And they discovered that despite her hanging and the beatings, she had a faint pulse and very low, shallow, weak breaths.
I mean, you go, girl, but I don't think I'd want to survive any of that.
Yeah. So Will and Thomas called their colleagues, Ralph Bathurst and Henry Clark, for help. The doctors tried many of the, like, tried and true methods to revive Anne, including pouring hot cordial down her throat, rubbing her limbs and other her extremities, bloodletting, which is like just like the withdrawal of blood from a patient done by either a physician or leeches.
Right.
Applying a poultice to her breasts. I looked this up, and it sounds like it's essentially like a warm washcloth that's heated up and has medicine applied to it and then applied to the affected area.
I like how it's to her boobs.
Yeah,
to her breasts. She's a lady, so
yeah,
her life source is her
and
breasts.
Finally, a tobacco smoke enema, which was a Native American practice.
I mean, I guess it's not far off from injecting cocaine into people, so
right.
I mean, well, they probably did startle you a little.
So after they tried all these methods, they moved her to a warm bed where another woman rubbed her and kept her warm.
Well, that part's probably nice.
Yeah. And it's not really clear what the golden method was, but Anne actually began to recover quite quickly. She was speaking after about 12 to 14 hours of treatment and was even eating solid foods 4 days later. Within a month, she was fully recovered, excluding some amnesia about the time surrounding her execution, which thank God.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah. After her recovery, she was granted a full pardon because the authorities thought that the hand of God saved her to prove her innocence.
Get the fuck out of here. Yeah.
She went on to marry and have 3 children before her true death in 1665.
This story is making me cuss a lot. This is insane.
I know.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's my second story. Oh my I took the 8 crazy nights to heart.
Yes, you did. Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
That's so weird.
Bonana.
Just tried to kill her like 12 times.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Oh, she is definitely a strong lady. Jeez.
I can only imagine. I can't imagine, actually.
No, I cannot imagine. Also wouldn't trust anyone ever, ever, ever again.
Right?
No, that's, yeah, mm-hmm. Alrighty. Well, let's just keep this party going.
Yes.
All right. So my third story is self-titled, A Family Slayed on New Year's Eve. So, a lot of spoilers right there. Okay, so just before midnight on New Year's Eve, 2017.
Oh, pretty recent.
Yes, very recent, coming 1600s to a couple years ago. A 16-year-old New Jersey boy gunned down 4 people in his Long Branch, New Jersey home. The teenager shot and killed his father, Stephen Kluge, who's 44, his mother, Linda Kluge, 42, his sister Brittany, who's 18, and a family friend, Mary Schultz, who was 70.
Oh, my God.
Police were called to the home around 11:43 p.m., and the suspect was taken into custody without incident, police stated. While the boy wasn't officially identified, neighbors said that it was actually their son, Scott Kluge. The suspect's brother and grandfather were also at the home at the time of the shooting, but were actually able to escape unharmed.
Lucky for them.
Yes. Yeah, so I guess, like, kind of something good. No.
Silver lining.
Yeah. Could have been worse, maybe? I don't know. The teenager was believed to have used a Sentry Arms semi-automatic assault rifle to gun down his victims, which was legally owned and registered to a family member. Apparently, on New Year's Eve, Scott found the rifle and, quote, took it outside to walk around the block to kill people. This was stated by his grandfather. Uh-huh. On his little walk, he decided, oh, I'm not going to go kill strangers. I'm going to go home and kill my family. Adrian, was his grandfather, said his grandson's brain was, quote, messed up by a tumor and nerve damage from childbirth. Okay. He said that he had tried to warn his parents, Steve and Linda, by saying that like, he had heard Scott, like, mentioning weird things and acting mm-hmm. a little strange, potentially saying that he might be interested in killing his family.
That's normal.
And then at some point, Scott got mad at him for, like, ratting him out to his parents. But in short, his grandfather said he was obsessed with killing his family. Scott was described to be on the autism spectrum and was homeschooled by his mother. Authorities won't discuss, like, what role, if any, like, developmental disabilities might have played.
Mm-hmm.
However, they did say the attack was isolated domestic incident and there was no known history of violence in the home.
Wow.
So we can make some assumptions, but they won't officially state it. When people were interviewed kind of close to the case, they said that the Kluges were a very caring, loving family and always looked to do fun things with their kids. They said that Scott was overall a good kid, but a little slow with the learning disabilities, but he knew right from wrong.
Okay.
They were overall a very close-knit family, and people were stunned to hear about the tragedy. Scott was originally charged as a juvenile in family court. In January 2018, a family court judge placed a gag order on the case, barring anyone connected to it from discussing it. In November 2019, police announced that Scott would actually be tried as an adult.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, so there aren't a ton of resources on this one, but because, like, he was a juvenile, so they didn't release everything.
Yeah.
But I know throughout this little process, there's also a lot of psychiatric evaluations.
Mm.
There's one piece I didn't actually, like, call out in this, but there was, I guess it was tapes, actually. Like, mm-hmm. videotapes, even, of Scott's interviews with police, where he actually admitted to killing his family.
Oh.
So maybe as, like, more of that information kind of came out.
Gotcha.
They changed their mind on maybe how, like, premeditated it was.
Yeah.
So, okay. I don't know. Where were we? Okay. In January of 2020, Scott was indicted on 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose. He faces a minimum sentence of 30 years in jail for each murder charge, with a maximum sentence of life in prison and a sentence of 5 to 10 years for the second degree weapons charge, according to the prosecutor's office. So it sounds like life.
Yeah.
Yep. Otherwise, yeah, you can be real old. But as far as I can tell, which I kind of find it odd that this isn't, like, easy to find, but Scott, I think, is awaiting his sentencing, like, his final sentencing from behind bars. But was scheduled, to have a psych evaluation in May of 2021. Oh. So I think, you know, COVID things are probably really holding that up, but
probably
he sits in jail while they wait for the final sentencing.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I think that one's all full mental issues.
Yeah.
Not so much like the anger. Bless you, dear.
Thank you. Sorry.
That's about it.
Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, so that's my next story.
Okay. Do you want to hear about more murder or do you want to hear about disappearances?
Well, I guess both. Let's go disappearance. Let's mix it up.
All right. Well, I'm going to tell you about the Bennington Triangle.
Ooh, I don't know what that is.
The Bennington Triangle is an area in the northeastern United States. The precise area is actually unclear, but it's supposed to be centered around the Glastonbury Mountains in Vermont and it includes most of the area of the towns, I wrote twins, that immediately surround it. Bennington, which it would be weird if that one wasn't included, Woodford, Shaftesbury, and Somerset. Glastonbury and Somerset were both thriving logging and industrial towns, but toward the later, I should also mention that this took place in, like, the main disappearances of this take place between 1946 and 1950.
Ah, okay.
Just for time frame.
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Yeah. So, like I said, Glastonbury and Somerset, they were both thriving logging industrial towns, but toward the later end of the 19th century, they both went on a decline and are essentially just ghost towns now. They were unincorporated by an act of the Vermont General Assembly in 1937, which really just means that they aren't governed by their own locality. Now, the name Bennington Triangle was actually coined by author Joseph Citro during a radio broadcast in 1992, when he was talking about the number of people that have gone missing in the area between 1945 and 1950. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, what I'm going to specifically highlight.
Okay, got it.
So, let's get to the first disappearance. The first reported disappearance was on November 12th of 1945. 74-year-old Mitty Rivers was out hunting and was guiding a group of four hunters through the mountains. Mitty was an experienced hunter, fisherman, and was super familiar with the area. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't have been a trail guide, right?
Yeah.
It'd be weird.
Yeah. Or the world's worst.
Or the world's worst, yeah. So on the way back from their hunting excursion, Mitty got ahead of the group and just, like, vanished, like, into thin air, basically. All that was found of him was a single rifle cartridge that was found in a stream, and it was speculated that he might have, like, leaned over the stream and the cartridge fell out of his pocket into the water.
Okay, yeah. Disappearance, sure.
So he just, like, poof.
Odd.
That's all that's ever been found of him is a bullet case.
Oh, still?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
To my knowledge.
Huh.
So the next year, in 1946, Paula Jean Weldon, who was an 18-year-old sophomore at Bennington College, disappeared on December 1st. She set out for a solo hike along the Long Trail. That's what it's called, the name of the trail.
Solo hike, always suspicious. Don't do that.
Yeah. She got directions from a local newspaper employee named Ernest Whitman, and was even seen on the trail by an elderly couple who was walking about 100 yards behind her on the same trail. They watched her go around a corner on the trail, and when they reached that same corner, they went around and she was not in their view anymore. That night, Paula didn't return to campus, and a massive search was conducted. The FBI got involved, and a $5,000 reward was even offered. What makes this one concerning is that it was 50 degrees out during the day, but at night, temperatures dropped down to just 9 degrees. And she wasn't wearing a jacket.
Well, that's just short-sighted.
She was probably planning on going home that night.
I know, but 50. I'm just thinking, I always bring a coat.
Yeah. No evidence was ever found, and unconfirmed rumors said that she either moved to Canada with a boyfriend or that she became a recluse that lives in the woods. And that one just sounds like local folklore to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that there are two random people, not connected at all, within a year, that go missing in the same place. Mm-hmm. They're both like, oh yeah, they just, like, both decided to abandon their lives and create totally new ones.
Right. Well, exactly 3 years after Paula disappeared, James Tedford also disappeared. James was a military veteran who was living at the Bennington Soldiers' Home and had been in nearby St. Albans visiting relatives. His family accompanied him to the bus to head back to the area, and that was the last time he was seen. Witnesses say that James got on the bus and was seen at the last stop before the bus arrived in Bennington, but somewhere between that stop and Bennington, he disappeared. At Bennington stop, his things were still on the luggage rack, and an open bus timetable was on his seat.
Hmm. Yeah.
That one's weird.
Just up and vanish.
Yeah.
No scuffle, no...
Yeah, nothing.
Hmm. Okay.
Then, slightly less than a year later, 9-year-old Paul Jeffson went missing. Paul and his mother had ridden to the area in a truck when she... Mother of the year left him alone for about an hour to go feed some pigs. I literally wrote, sorry, what? She came back to the truck and Paul was nowhere to be found. Search parties set out looking for him in his bright red jacket, since thinking that would make him, you know, a little bit more visible. According to local legend, I like to say local legend in this story, apparently, bloodhounds tracked Paul's scent to the entrance of the trail that Paula Wedden had disappeared from. Dun, dun, dun.
Aliens. It's aliens.
Yeah. That one just sounds like a child abduction to me.
Yeah. But these are all weird and they have to be connected, but they're not similar in nature at all.
Right. All right. So just a little over 2 weeks after little Paul disappeared, Frieda Langer and her cousin Herbert Sissner were camping with their family. They decided they were going to leave the campsite and go for a little hike. Well, Frieda slipped and fell into the stream. Been there.
Haven't we all?
Been there, done that.
Wet shoes. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they got too far from camp because she told Herbert that if he would just wait there, she would go back to camp and change into some dry clothes, and then they could finish their hike. So it had to have been, like, pretty close to the campsite. My assumption.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, you would think.
Well, after what seemed to have been a decent enough time for her to, like, have gone and changed and come back, she wasn't back, so Herbert was like, well, what the fuck's going on? So he went back to the campsite. When he got there, their family said that she hadn't come back and they hadn't seen her since she left with him to go camping. Hiking. They went hiking. Over the next 2 weeks, 5 searches were conducted, including with airplanes, helicopters, and over 300 searchers, but no trace of Frieda was found. 7 months later, her body was discovered just 3.5 miles from the camp in an area that had been lightly searched previously. She was found at the Somerset Reservoir in the east branch of the Deerfield River. Because of the condition of her body, no cause of death could be determined. Okay, so those are the original 5 disappearances that earned the area the nickname the Bennington Triangle. And, like, I think you might have pointed out, no direct connections can be made other than, like, the time period and the location. I'm not done yet.
Yeah, this is all weird. Okay.
So, there have been more recent instances. On September 17th of 2019, a jawbone was found in a gravel pit near the Somerset Reservoir. The jawbone was later identified as the remain belonging to a 43-year-old New York resident named Jessica Hildenbrandt, who went by the nickname Red. Now, you might remember that little Paul was wearing a red jacket. The color red is apparently somewhat conspicuous surrounding this area. How, you might ask?
I do, actually.
Let me tell you about another instance that involves the color red. This one actually took place August of this year. And for future listeners, it is 2021. 73-year-old Joseph Schoenig, I think that's how you say his name, was found just a few weeks after he was reported missing with a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his red pickup truck. And even more, he was parked near the Somerset Reservoir.
All right, so you can't go there.
No. Not in my red car. I used more than Wikipedia on that one. I also used All That's Interesting, Ranker, and Thought Catalog. Just FYI, for anybody who wants credit.
Oh, thanks. I haven't read any of my sources and making me look like a butthead.
I mean, if the shoe fits.
Oh, wow.
kidding.
Is that
that's it. That's all I got.
Just cold right at the end.
Cold hard stop.
Wow. Well, that's weird.
Yeah, that one's,
you said it's in Vermont?
Yeah.
Witches.
Ooh, maybe.
Witches.
Yeah. All right, what's your last story?
All right, my last one. And this one's for you, Nicole.
Yay!
The disappearance of 2 New Zealanders.
Kiwis!
Kiwis! Appearance of 2 Kiwis. Oh, that's what I should have said. The disappearance of 2 Kiwis. I don't know if you've heard of this. The people that disappeared, well, I'll say it very shortly, too, are Ben Smart and Olivia Hope. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
I hadn't either. Their names sound familiar, but they're also, like, pretty common names. So, also, like, Smart. And anyways. Okay, let's just get to it. In December of 1997, friends Ben Smart, who was 21, and Olivia Hope, 17, celebrated New Year's Eve at the Furneaux Lodge. We'll pretend that's how you say it, located in Endeavor Inlet of Marlborough Sounds, with about, you know, a casual small group of 1,500 to 2,000 other people.
Casual small group. Yes. That's about right.
Olivia had traveled to the lodge with a group on a chartered yacht called the Tamarack, while Ben had arrived separately. At about 4 a.m., the lodge bartender, Guy Wallace, drove them in his water taxi back to the Tamarack, where the pair intended to sleep. When Ben and Olivia got aboard, they found that there were no vacant beds remaining, and they reboarded the water taxi. At the time, he had three other passengers on board. That was Hayden Morsey, Sarah Dyer, and a single man whose identity was not originally known. The single man offered the pair a place to sleep on what he said was his yacht. Guy let Ben and Olivia off with this man at the yacht and left to drop the other two passengers. This was the last time Ben and Olivia were seen alive.
Who is this mystery man? He's the murderer!
Who was it? So, Ben and Olivia were reported missing on January 2nd of 1998. Initially, the police treated the investigation as a missing persons case, but it soon became apparent that the disappearance was suspicious and out of character for the duo, so it was restructured as a homicide case. The investigation was called Operation TAM, short for Tamarack, and generated widespread interest from the public and media. The investigation was large, featuring requests for information from the public, significant amounts of interviews across the country, and months of extensive searches of the waters surrounding the Endeavor Inlet. Despite this, no bodies were ever found. With little to go on, the police began trying to determine the identity of the unknown man that Ben and Olivia were last seen with. In his police statements, Guy Wallace, who was the water taxi driver, described the unknown passenger as having about 2 days' growth on his face, possibly arm tattoos, a wiry build, he was about 5'9", with short, dark, wavy hair, and being scruffy in appearance overall, wearing a Levi shirt with jeans. Okay. Guy maintained that the man on the water taxi was the same notable man that other staff had served at the lounge bar earlier that evening. This was crucial to police, because while the witnesses couldn't actually identify the man on the water taxi, they could identify the man in the bar. So Scott Watson became a suspect.
Dun, dun, dun.
Looking into Scott, he had a previous criminal history, totaling 48 convictions.
Jesus.
Yeah. Busy man that ranged from theft to assault. A witness to the assault described Scott as a scary little bastard. Yeah, that's a good quote. Apparently, he spat at him and tried to intimidate him because he was going to be a witness for one of his assault charges.
Oh.
When police interviewed Scott's friends and associates, some said that he would often become aggressive and crude towards women when intoxicated. Others said that he had enthusiastically talked about the idea of raping and killing women on more than one occasion, and he bragged that he could get away with murder.
Sounds like a winner.
Right? I feel like that's, you know, like 20 red flags thrown right at once. But
it's a sea of red flags.
Mm-hmm. So when Guy Wallace was brought in, he was able to ID the single man as, indeed, the guy that was on the water taxi that evening. Police searched Scott's home and his family's homes, tapped his phone, and interviewed more of his friends.
Wait, why are they not searching his boat?
Oh, I think that was his home.
Oh, he lived on the boat.
If it's not actually his home, that was also in there. I just shortened the sentence. So, yes, they also looked at his boat.
Cool.
Actually, and on that note, just because you brought it up, one of them said that there had been, like, recent work done on the boat where he had, like, painted some things and changed some stuff. So, also very suspicious.
Not suspect at all.
Mm-hmm. In the early hours of June 15th, 1998, Scott was arrested for the murders after 5 months of the pair being reported. The trial started on June 10th, 1999, and verdicts were delivered on September 11th. Scott was convicted of the murders and sentenced to life in prison, with a minimum of non-parole period of 17 years. Different number. Mm. Scott continues to claim that he is innocent, even telling the jury, "You're wrong," when the verdict came out in court.
You're wrong.
You're wrong. In November of 2021, so again, very recent, Watson was declined parole for the fourth time.
Scott.
His next parole board hearing is scheduled for October of 2023, and his appeal is due mid-year of 2022. So he's still attempting to fight it, but sits in jail.
Suck on that one, Scott.
Oh, isn't it weird, though, that they never even found the bodies? What if they ran away? What if they're one of the, like, actual disappearances and not a murder?
Yeah.
Maybe they disappeared in your place.
Yeah, they just went to Vermont.
Just casual.
Super close to New Zealand.
Maybe they're time travelers.
Ooh, maybe.
Teleporters? Teleporters would make more sense for what I just said.
Uh-huh.
Yep. All right, cool. Yeah. On that note, on to your story.
All right. My last one I have titled Alan Grimson, the almost maybe serial killer.
Almost maybe,
almost
huh?
maybe.
All right, let's find out.
All right. So, I first heard about this guy, Alan, on episode 9 of Killer Cocktails. So that's obviously one of my major sources. Let's talk about Alan Grimson. He was born in Northumberland, United Kingdom. Really like London on this one.
I know. So international.
I know. Well, he was born in 1958, and I don't really know much about his early life other than that he was the third of 5 children. And I know that he joined the British Royal Navy in 1978. At the time of, spoiler alert, his conviction, he had reached the rank of petty officer and had served as a trainer in firefighting techniques. Alan's first confirmed victim was 18-year-old Nicholas Wright, who was also in the Royal Navy. The two met while Nicholas was assigned to a firefighting course run by the Royal Navy in November 1997. And due to their age difference, their rank and rank difference between Nicholas and Alan, they weren't supposed, like, because of their rank difference, they weren't supposed to, like, be social with one another. Like, outside of, like, the course that Alan was teaching.
Yeah. They weren't supposed to fraternize.
Yeah, no fraternization. But, you know, rules made to be broken.
Yeah, it's like, the way you stated that, alas.
Yeah. So, Alan actually offered to give Nick a ride. Don't know if he went by Nick, but he doesn't know my story now. Jesus.
This is a good final buddy, one.
Buddy, buddy with everybody, apparently. All right. Do I lost my spot? Oh, so Alan offered to give Nicholas a ride home on weekends. But because of their age difference, his family was like, this is kind of suspect. What's this guy's deal? What does he really want? But, you know, Nick was like, whatever. Take that part out.
No, I just like that you keep going back between Nick and Nicholas, and, like, the Nick ones are much more casual.
I haven't been drinking today. All right. Anyway. In early December, Nicholas was on shore leave, and on or around December 12th of 1997, he was seen out drinking with Alan. They left a nightclub, and they went back to Alan's place, where he tried to kiss Nicholas. But Nick said, nah, bro. Sorry. Nicholas rejected the advances by Alan, and Alan did not react well. He started punching him. And then he grabbed a baseball bat and hit him several times.
Okay, well, that just is unnecessary.
It is. And Alan reports that at this point, Nicholas just looked at him and said, why don't you just kill me already? So he did.
Aw! Oh, okay. What a good idea.
He grabbed a carving knife and cut Nicholas's throat.
Oh, God.
Then he put his body in the bathtub and would later dump it beside the A272 road near Cheriton, which was about an hour's drive from Alan's apartment, and it was near a field.
That seems super unnecessary, but okay.
Yeah. So Nicholas's crewmates reported him missing, and the military police got involved and even questioned Alan. But He lied and was able to keep himself out of the investigation. Boo. The following December, 1998, Allen killed his second known victim, 20-year-old... Okay, so when I Googled the pronunciation of this word, because this name, it says Sion, but in Killer Cocktails podcast, they called him Sean.
Okay.
So I guess we'll just go with Sean.
Yeah, whichever one feels right. We know who you're referring to. That's yes, the only important part.
The second victim, Sion Sean
mm-hmm.
Jenkins, was originally from Newbury. Newbury? Yeah. And hadn't been in the Royal Navy for very long. When Allen murdered him, he was working as a barman in the Hogshead Pub in Portsmouth. Hogshead, like in Harry Potter. On the night of his murder, Sean had met up with Allen. I'm going to guess the one with Sean. Had met up with Allen at a nightclub called Joanna's. Allen proceeded to get Sean very drunk, took him home, and forced him to have sex with him by punching and threatening him. The next morning, Sean tried to peace out, but Allen was like, nah, bro. And he bound him to the bathtub and got his trusty baseball bat and beat him to death. He left Sean's body off of the A32 road just 4 miles from where he had dumped Nicholas. And I know. In December of 1999, investigators were still looking into Nicholas's disappearance, and they brought Allen back in for some questioning. He finally admitted to killing Nicholas and even gave up his more recent murder of Sean. He also admitted that he had scoured the trainees and cadets of his courses so that he could dominate and kill the best-looking ones. He said that he got a thrill from dominating and killing the younger men, but claimed that there was no sexual element to his crimes, despite also admitting that the thrill was better than an orgasm. Not to mention, like, he forced at least one of the men to have sex with him, and there was also evidence of sexual torture post-mortem. So, he a liar.
This guy needs some therapy.
He went to trial and was convicted in 2001, where the judge convicted him to 21 years in jail, but suggested that he never be released. The justice also told Allen that he was a serial killer in nature, if not in number. All right. Now, I did title this one an almost maybe serial killer. Well, as we know, a serial killer has to have committed 3 murders, and we know that Allen committed 2.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say he hasn't been considered for more. In 1986, Simon Parks, who was a junior enlisted officer, went missing. He had served on the HMS Illustrious with Allen, and at the time of his disappearance, witnesses placed the two together on that night. Allen, of course, denies having killed Simon, but police speculate that since Allen killed on or around December 12th of each year, and that's the time that Simon went missing, you know, probably was him. Also, because of the timing of his murders, they speculate that he could have a range of 11 to 20 unidentified victims.
Whoa, there's a huge range.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah. There's also an instance that took place in 1998 when he was working for the Royal New Zealand Navy on an exchange program, where a 29-year-old female Japanese immigrant, Kayo Matsuzawa, was found dead and hidden in a fire alarm cupboard. Yeah. Allen was considered one of the suspects because he was friendly with the manager of the building that her body was found in, but he was never charged with the crime, and it also doesn't fit with his other murders because the other people he is convicted of were men, and she's a lady.
Maybe it's part of the escalation.
I don't know.
Maybe he was working through what he like identified as.
Oh, he was gay.
But I wonder if he always thought that. Maybe it was a murder of convenience.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, that's Allen.
Well, then. Sounds like a real
winner.
Dickhead.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. I'm going to go with he probably did kill more than just those two people.
Yeah, most likely. Well, those are 8 crazy nights of crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hope you enjoyed a couple of short stories.
Yes. Don't forget to like us, rate us, review us, subscribe to us. Subscribe to us. How about that one? You want to take over since apparently I can't talk?
I think that's probably all for this week.
And take care of yourselves.
And I'll do my own resources since I have them open.
Oh, perfect.
The easy one is it's Wikipedia. I also have grunge.com and foxnews.com, nj1015.com, app.com, and some more Wikipedia. What about you?
I have allthat'sinteresting.com, ranker.com, thoughtcatalog.com, obviously Wikipedia, Killer Cocktails Podcast, my true crime calendar, and executedtoday.com, and that is it.
Cool.
See you later.
All right, goodbye.
Bye.
That's weird. Bye.